Yeah, it looks like my computer's not working tonight. I'll have to do without it. Or somebody else will have to help me when I need computer work. K2 Romeo India Whiskey. My call letters. Technet number 1533, beginning a little late. As you guys know by now, the main reason for the technet is that we help educate each other, particularly about radio and radio techniques, antennas, transmission lines, and things like that. Person signs into the technical net because they've got a question or a comment. They're going to give us your call letters, your name, and the word yes, which says you do have a question or a comment. I did hear VE3 X-ray Sierra Hotel, W-E-2-R-Y-Y. So those two guys are already checked in. Anyone else want to check in? Give me your call letters right now. K2RIW.
K2FQU with a question, and my name is John, Juliet Oscar November, mobile.
C2, Mount Laurel, New Jersey, John.
Okay, Mount Laurel, New Jersey, pick you up in a second. K2, is it Foxtrot Juliet Uniform? Did I have that one correct, John?
The K2 Kilowatt 2 Foxtrot Queen Uniform, mobile.
Foxtrot Queen Uniform, okay. Yorktown, New Jersey, please give me your call letters again and your name. I think it's John.
Charlie 2, Sierra Hotel Oscar. We're in Mount Laurel, New Jersey, about 10 miles outside of Philadelphia. And yes, it's John here. No question this evening.
Okay, John number 2, Mount Laurel, with no questions. Anyone else is checking? Give me your call letters and name right now.
N2XGN, I wanted to take you, you had a time to go to the email because I would like to postulate Roy for tonight with the subject of time reversal violation. There are three parts of it. One is especially interesting for ham radio amateurs, which is electromagnetic communication deathbed with time reversal. If you had a chance to do that, then I will leave the floor to Roy. N2XGN.
That's right, sir. I haven't seen an email on that subject, Wes. As I said, my computer's not working tonight. So, I'm not sure we're going to get to that subject. Okay, let's see if anyone else to check in, because they do have a question or a comment. Give me your call letters and name right now. K2RIW.
The US 2N call with a space report. Good evening, everybody.
I've got you, Paul. GC2. Okay. Let's see if the first person who checked in much earlier does have a question. Victor Echo 3, X-ray Sierra Hotel. K2RIW, go right ahead, sir.
There, Nick. It's Christian here, VE3XSH, up in Toronto, Ontario. Thanks so much for letting me into your net. It's the greatest thing on ham radio, in my opinion. I just wanted to ask you simple questions as a warm-up, I guess. A couple of weeks ago, I replaced the ceramic filters on my Yaesu radio, and I realized I had no clue what these things are, and I've been looking on the internet to find some information on what they are and how they work, and I can't find anything about it, so I thought you'd be the perfect person to ask. So basically, I'm just looking for some, you know, basic information on how ceramic filters or mechanical filters, how they function, how they work. Thanks so much.
Your particular ceramic filter, Christian, do you happen to know what frequency it operates on?
Those were just the basic filters. I think one of them is for HF, one is for VHF, and one is for UHF, so I had to replace three. And of course, there's the option of a Collins filter that I can get, which costs like almost $200. And so this is sort of that I'm sort of wondering, well, what's the difference between a low-end and a high-end mechanical filter, and what's the difference between those and a sort of a crystal-type base filter? It was just sort of a big surprise to me to learn that there was a mechanical aspect to my radio at all, so I was just wanting to learn a little bit about that. Thanks.
It's kind of hard to believe some of the things that are electronic versus mechanical. You take, for instance, your medical ultrasound machine, which operates at something like 1 megahertz. And it's 1 megahertz of not a RF signal. It's an acoustic signal that does ultrasound. So in other words, you have a kind of transducer, a piezoelectric crystal, which when you apply voltage to it, it mechanically changes size or it mechanically bends. That's what a quartz crystal does, for instance. A quartz crystal resonator is a mechanical resonator. And so you apply voltage to it, it deflects because of its physical size. You could say it rings like a bell at a particular frequency. And as such, properly constructed, these things can have extremely high Q in the case of a crystal resonator. In the case of a crystal filter, well, you can build a crystal filter out of individual quartz crystals. You can build a crystal filter. You can build a mechanical filter out of a mechanical transducer. Here we go. Electronic to mechanical transducer. In other words, you can mechanically vibrate one side of a mechanical structure. That's usually kind of a complicated. And it has particular physical resonant frequencies. And out of the far side of it, you convert the mechanical energy back into electrical energy. The Collins mechanical filter was, for a long time, considered near the state-of-the-art of IF filters. Let me drop. If you saw the mechanical filter itself, I believe it was a large chunk of mechanical material. I'm not quite sure what the exact material was, which has a whole bunch of slices to it, saw cuts to it, and each one of those represented an individual resonator. The electrical equivalent of a Collins mechanical filter is a large number of LC resonators. That was the mechanical electronic equivalent, so to speak, where each one has very high Q. In other words, as if it consists of an inductor with very little in series resistance to it, an ideal capacitor across that, and large numbers of those with just the right coupling coefficient. The bottom line of all that is that a Collins mechanical filter can have a filter shape that is very hard to duplicate by any other means in a reasonable size package. In other words, you could, I think, buy a Collins filter that has exactly a 2.1 kilohertz bandwidth to it, a flat top of 2.1 kilohertz wide. It might start off at 600 hertz and go to 2.7 kilohertz, so to speak. And then on each end is an extremely sharp cutoff. The way you measure, let me drop. The way you measure the quality of a filter is what is its 3 dB bandwidth, what is its 6 dB bandwidth, what is its 60 dB bandwidth. If the filter has brick wall sides, so to speak, in other words, the difference between the 6 the places where it has 6 kilohertz, here we go, 6 decibels of roll-off versus 60 decibels of roll-off could be an extremely small ratio, like 1.5 to 1, so to speak. A sloppy filter would have 60 dB bandwidth that is very wide, and a very sharp filter of the Collins type can have a 60 dB bandwidth that's only just a little bit wider than the 6 dB bandwidth, because the skirts of the filter are so extremely sharp. So you can build a filter out of mechanical material, ceramic material, the so-called crystal filters. Let me think now. Ceramic filter. The ceramic filter also, to my knowledge, is another kind of piezoelectric material. You pay your money, you take your choice. The really good filters, let me drop. The really good filters have a large number of equivalent poles with just the right coupling coefficient between those poles. Pole, by the way, is the electronic word for a kind of a resonator. So a single inductor and capacitor across each other is one pole of a filter. And you could put a whole lot of those poles together if you're a real smart filter designer. Another kind of filter that is extremely high in quality is a SAW filter, S-A-W, Surface Acoustic Wave Filter. Again, it's really mechanical. So you start off with an electronic signal, That in turn goes through some kind of an electronic to mechanical transducer, a piezoelectric material. It then vibrates something physically in order to do the resonating and filtering. And then you take that that vibration signal at the tail end of the filter, convert it back to electronics. So saw filters, bore filter, BAW, crystal filter, mechanical filter. As you can tell, there's lots and lots of filters. But a good number of them, as you can tell, work by mechanical means, not purely electronic means. In fact, the reference crystal that's in this frequency synthesizer of the radio you're doing right now, let me drop. That reference crystal could very well be a 10 megahertz crystal. And depending on the mechanical method of laying out that particular crystal, the highest Q crystal I know of, crystal resonator, is one where the actual quartz crystal is mounted in a glass envelope, which is a high vacuum, so that there isn't even any air dampening of the mechanical motion of the crystal. And so it is possible to build a single pole crystal resonator with a Q as high as half a million. Q, one of the many definitions of Q is center frequency divided by bandwidth. If you had a filter that is 10 megahertz wide, a 10 megahertz center frequency, but only 1 hertz wide at the half power bandwidth, 1 hertz divided into 10 megahertz would be a Q of 10 million. Well, you don't get Qs that quite that high, but just gives you an example. If the Q was 1 million, I guess it would be 10 hertz wide. If it was 20 hertz wide, it would be half a million Q. Half a million Q is achievable. You're going to pay for a thing like that, obviously. It takes very careful construction techniques by somebody very skilled in the art. I'm sure there are people who have used Collins crystal filters on frequency. In its day, let me pick a number, in the mid-1960s and 70s, where Collins was the real Cadillac of radios, those Collins crystal filters, or the Collins so-called mechanical filters, at the time seemed to be the best thing you could buy, and the only thing that really challenged them, let me drop, are the filters that use more modern digital techniques. You can also do filtering by taking the analog signal, converting it between analog and a digital waveform. You then do computer processing, digital signal processing of that computer digital waveform, and then at the end of that filtering process, you convert that back into an analog signal. So your frequency synthesizer really is doing a combination of those things. So of the people who are on frequency, who have got more smarts than I do on Collins and other kinds of mechanical filters, please give us your call with us right now. K2LIW listening. Under normal circumstances, there are normally Collins aficionados on frequency, and where for a time the best filter you could buy was that Collins mechanical filter, because of its very ideal filter shape, if you know what I mean. That's some of the information, Christian. We may have to dig a little bit deeper in future weeks to give you the rest of it, but at least you've got a start. I'm sure if you Google some of the words we've talked about, guarantee Wikipedia has got some good information on this one. Victor Echo 3, X-Ray Sierra Hotel, K2LIW, the TechNet. You got it, Christian.
Yeah, I guess a sort of related question, something I was wondering about before, is about quartz. Hold on. My question is about quartz. You know, when they're making the quartz filters in the factory, is it the case where every single quartz filter resonates at the exact same frequency no matter what? Or is it the case that each one of those quartz filters has to be sort of individually tested to figure out its resonance, and that its clocking is based on that calibration? Do you understand what I'm asking? Just whether or not quartz always resonates at the same frequency, or if they have to sort of fine-tune it.
I was waiting for the beep, but by the message that you're coming in, we don't get a beep. A quartz resonator, quartz filter, a quartz crystal resonator, I've seen them as low as 250 kilohertz. I'm sure they come lower than that. and I believe they go up to approximately 20 megahertz, is the highest fundamental frequency of a quartz crystal resonator. And then by using the third harmonic, the fifth harmonic, and the second harmonic, seventh harmonic, so to speak, you can get a quartz crystal resonator, a frequency determining crystal, as high as about 140 megahertz. It is the physical size of the piece of quartz that determines its mechanical resonating frequency. It's like a bell. You can have a large bell or a small bell. The small bell tends to ring at a much higher frequency, very similar to what goes on with a quartz resonating crystal. The physical size determines the resonating frequency. In the old days, where we amateurs used to use a FT-243 crystal holder, that's the one that's got the two prongs coming out of the bottom that are about half inch apart. The outer package has a front plate that's held on by four screws. You remove those four screws, you're looking at the piece of quartz resonator itself. It is a white material, slightly, white is not quite the right word. Let's call it a cream-colored material, about a half inch or three-quarter inch square, and probably a 16th of an inch thick. You took that piece of quartz out of there. Maybe your particular quartz crystal started off at 7.1 megahertz, and if you did the right kind of, let me call it sanding, you took that piece of quartz material, you put it between two very flat pieces of glass with just the right grinding
repeater. Time out.
The Eastern repeater just came back on. You put it between two very smooth materials, which might be window glass, with just the right kind of grinding compound, and you take one fifty thousandth of an inch out of the thickness of that, grinding it, cleaning it up, and putting it back in, and the quartz resonator that used to be on 7.1 megahertz is now on 7.105 megahertz. You've made it a little bit thinner. Its resonant frequency is now a little bit higher because you changed its physical size. At the factory where they make crystal resonators, if they're trying to make a resonator intended for a frequency reference for frequency synthesizers, maybe it's at 10 megahertz, if they've got very good control, they may be able to make a whole batch of them that come out very close to 10 megahertz. I think they have to fine-tune them, though, because when you and I buy a 10 megahertz crystal resonator, we want it to be 10 megahertz plus or minus a very small fraction of a kilohertz, and maybe even individual hertz of accuracy is what you're designing, what you desire. And can they manufacture them with that much accuracy? I kind of doubt it. I think each one of them has to be fine-tuned, even when you want them all on the same frequency. So the main thing to worry about now is physical size determines resonant frequency. And there's a couple of other very critical variables involved here. Let me drop it. The native quartz material that comes out of the ground has a grain structure to it. Depending on how you cut your desirable slab out of it, you can cut it horizontally, vertically, in a slant angle, and whatever, with reference to that grain. And each one of those cuts has got the various temperature characteristics. I think one of them is called an XY cut, so to speak. So there's various letters they put in front of the method by which you cut the raw material in order to get your particular crystal blank to start the process. Each individual way of cutting the quartz can have a different kind of temperature characteristic. By that I mean the frequency goes up when the temperature goes up, or the frequency goes down when the temperature goes up. And if you cut it just right, you can make near zero temperature coefficient. That's the one you really want, because on a hot day, you'd like to be on the same frequency as on a cold day. Some of the crystal resonators that are put into the brick oscillator assemblies that people use for microwave oscillators, let me drop. They get around that problem by choosing just the right cut of the quartz crystal to begin with, then the crystal resonator, which in some cases is around 100 megahertz of fifth overtone, that in itself is put into an extremely small electronic oven. the electronic oven may be 1 cubic inch. It's got a heater inside with all kinds of insulation on the outside, some kind of a thermal sensor that sets the temperature at, let me pick a number, 70 degrees centigrade, plus or minus 1 degree. By putting the crystal into an oven, you now have removed one of the variables where on a hot day versus a cold day, your crystal resonator is going to be on the right frequency. As you can tell, there's a whole art and science to building a crystal resonator. That's just one single resonator. And in the old days, some of the really good filters were created by taking a whole lot of those individual crystal resonators, putting them together in an assembly with just the right coupling coefficient capacitors in between them, in an elaborate tuning process. You could come very close to the quality of a Collins mechanical resonator, but I'm not quite sure you could get there all the way. By the way, in the case of a surface acoustic wave filter, if you actually look at the individual fingers, let me drop. If you took one of those apart and looked at it under a microscope, you'd see a whole bunch of individual fingers. Some fingers jutting in from the right side, some fingers jutting in from the left side, and those fingers overlap each other. This is a microscopic structure I'm describing. And so a properly constructed surface acoustic wave filter, each one of those fingers is an individual resonator, and it is possible to build a surface acoustic wave filter that has 50 separate fingers to it. In other words, it has the equivalent of 50 individual inductor, capacitor, electronic resonators, so to speak, all built into a structure which is hard to see without looking at it under a microscope. As you can tell, we're talking about rather high precision microscopic fabrication techniques. So if you simply look up the word surface acoustic wave, or SAW filter, you'll see another modern day class of filters which do seriously challenge what used to be the state of the art, the Collins mechanical filter. That's some of the information I know on the subject. I'm far from an expert on this one, Christian. VE3, X-ray Sierra Hotel, K2IW in the TechNet.
As always, that's a great answer, Dick, and I think the only thing that you're wrong about with that is that that information is available online, because believe me, I looked and looked, and there's nothing like a good fellow ham radio operator or TechNet to help you understand something when it's not available online. I guess what it is this technology is sort of predates the internet, so technologies that sort of came along with the internet are very well published, but technologies that are pre-internet are just not out there. So I really appreciate you giving me that answer. And with that, I'll hand it back to the net, because I'm curious to hear the next question. Thanks very much. This is Victor Echo 3, X-ray Sugar Hotel, clear.
As you can tell, Christian, I sense there's a lot more information on this subject than you've heard tonight. As such, you're allowed to re-ask the question again next week. Hopefully other people who have more experience with these kinds of filters will be present next week and they give us the benefit of their experience. I have used some surface acoustic wave filters. I was working for Airborne Instruments Laboratory, which had a so-called central research group that was synthesizing and generating those kind of filters in the mid-1960s and 1970s, and some of those filters were used on the very elaborate receiver of the B-1 bomber program. AIL, Airborne Instruments Laboratory, was not able to buy the quality of filters on the center frequencies they wanted, the bandwidth that they wanted, so the central research group, a high technology group, separate department of the company, built their own surface acoustic wave filters, and those filters did become a key part of the so-called, the frequency measuring box. There was 100 individual boxes on that receiver, and one of the very last boxes was the so-called frequency encoder box. To get the fine frequency resolution, it came out of 15 individual surface acoustic wave filters, where each individual filter had the equivalent of 50 poles. As you can see, we're talking about rather expensive, high technology equipment in its day. And The good news is that the modern-day surface acoustic wave filters have a much smaller insertion loss, much smaller size than the ones that were being fabricated in those days. Like everything else, the
repeater, timeout.
Okay, the Eastern repeater has come back on. So that technology, like many others, continuously progresses. Okay, the next guy on our list was Joe, W-A-2-R-Y-Y. What would you like to discuss tonight, Joe? K-2-R-I-W in the SICKNET.
What would I like to discuss? Okay, well, maybe I think it's a subject I may have brought back before, brought up here before, but I guess it's interesting anyway. In constructing a multi-frequency operating dipole, I realize I might have a problem with tuning the thing, and I guess if you go over again, I guess maybe either a strategy to use or what kind of effect I'm going to expect in constructing this thing with a thing about maybe 5 to 10 feet off the ground compared to its normal height, about 25 or 30 feet with the balance of suspended above the ground. I think in the past you mentioned that it does change tuning somewhat on some of the bands. I guess the lower frequency you go, it has more of an effect between that and the ground. But maybe you can go over this again, because I do want to start getting going on this thing and constructing a multi-band dipole. And I can't construct it up in the air in its, you know, final resting place, so to speak. I can't get to the wire. So I'm going to have to prop the thing up in the middle and have it low enough where I can stretch the wire out and tune it that way. But any other comments on something like this, or any comments at all, Dick? Back to you.
Yeah, when it comes to a multi-frequency dipole, there's two entirely different classes of doing that. One is a single dipole-like structure, which has a bunch of interruptions in it where there are individual LC networks distributed along the dipole. That's one kind of multi-frequency dipole. The more simple multi-frequency dipole to build for the first time, if you're not doing a designing job, is the so-called fan dipole. In other words, if I wanted a dipole on 80, and a dipole on 40, and a dipole on 20, and a dipole on 10 meters, and I take those four lengths of half-wavelength wire of those four individual dipoles, bring them all together at one common point, one common center insulator, fan them all out from each other at, let me pick a number, a 10-degree spacing, angular spacing of 10 degrees, usually vertically, but not necessarily. They could be horizontally displaced 10 degrees from each other. And that kind of a fan dipole is a lot easier to build than many of the others, because the individual dipoles almost tune independently. Let me drop. And the average person will start off tuning the lowest frequency, the longest length dipole first. By making it a little bit shorter and longer, you can decide that the bathtub curve of standing wave ratio plotted versus frequency, and almost all dipole-like structures, when you plot, as you sweep the frequency at 3.5, 3.6, 3.7, 3.8 megahertz, and you measure the standing wave ratio, and you make a graph out of that, where the horizontal axis is frequency, and the vertical axis is the standing wave ratio you measure on a good SWR meter, SWR meter. When you plot that, you usually get a U-shaped curve, a bathtub-shaped curve, and the lowest point on that bathtub is usually the resonant frequency. And by adjusting the length, if your favorite frequency on 80 meters was 3750, you could make that dip at the bottom of that bathtub occur at 3750 by making the length a little bit longer and a little bit shorter. So you do that first on the 80-meter dipole, and the 40-meter dipole is almost independent. There's a catch to all of this, and that is, as you make the fanning angle, as you make the angle between the individual dipoles at the center smaller and smaller, you do start getting more and more interaction. Let me drop. Where, as you adjust the length of the 40-meter dipole, for instance, it will have an extremely minor effect on the resonant frequency of the 80-meter dipole. It'll probably have a greater interaction with the resonant frequency of the 20-meter dipole. And so there's a little bit of a juggling act to get everything to come out right. The most extreme case I know of is where people have taken the four or five wires that are in the ribbon cable that used to a kind of a ham-ham rotator, for instance, and by cutting those individual wires in that ribbon at just the right length, you can make a multi-frequency dipole out of that. But now your fanning angle is so darn small, the interaction between the individual dipoles starts getting very large, and therefore the tuning process becomes a lot more arduous. A smarter guy is going to be supporting his dipole between two high trees on his property, and at least one of those trees, the support will include a pulley up in the tree with a rope coming down to the ground, going to a weight or a spring. Let me drop it. And by loosing that halyard, you're able to lower the dipole assembly to the ground, do your tuning, then pull on that rope with that pulley at the top of the tree and haul it back up again. You don't have to be climbing the tree, if you know what I mean. So there are guys who have done mechanical arrangements by that means or a similar means by which they can tune their dipole standing on the ground. In other words, you make it a little bit longer or shorter, haul it back up, make a measurement, decide that you've gone the right direction, the right amount, but you've got to do a little bit more trimming or add a little bit more wire on. If you do over-trim a particular dipole, you cut off too much, you say to yourself, well, I can't add wire back on. You absolutely can. You're most likely going to be adding wire back on near the tips of the dipole. Near the tips of the dipole, the amount of current soldering it, if you want good mechanical strength, let me drop. By you can moments of the dipole where the wire is the full length to begin with, as opposed to you cutting it too short and twisting together an extra piece in order to bring it back up to length. The modified dipole, by adding an extra length of twisted wire properly soldered together, if you compare the performance of those two dipoles, you'd never be able to see the difference. So don't worry about that. Dipoles are nowhere near as critical as you think. There are people who lose a lot of sleep at night worrying about if they build their dipoles out of 14-gauge household wire, will they get a significant difference in tuning if they leave the rubber insulation on or take the rubber insulation off? In most cases, the answer, it makes no difference, with one exception. Let me drop. In the case of the square loop Yagi antenna, Quaggy antenna, where it was a cubical quad-like structure for the driven element, and the rest of the elements are ordinary dipole-like structures. That kind of a Yagi structure, which was invented by Wayne Overbeck, W6YFK, I think it was his call letters, and that was a Yagi on 432 megacycles consisting of something like 13 or 15 elements. On that particular antenna, the wire loop of the driven element did make a difference whether you used 14-gauge wire or the equivalent that was sold in Germany, which was built to some number of millimeters of diameter. And depending on whether you left the German rubber insulation on versus the American rubber insulation, in one case, the Yagi, you've desired the Yagi to work on 432.1, and depending on which method of construction you used, it might end up on 432.7 instead of 432.1 for its best frequency, if you know what I mean, and a little bit of readjustment of size is required. So in that particular case, a resonator built out of wire with or without the rubber insulation did make a difference. But that's a cubical quad-like structure inside of a Yagi antenna. The normal dipole you and I build spread out into the air, as we're describing it, the rubber insulation, the enamel insulation, no insulation, copper oxide on the outside of it, very, very minor differences. It would take careful laboratory measurements to see the difference. I know that you're about to build a multi-frequency dipole. Let me drop it. Out of very exotic silver-plated wire that you've recently acquired, and if I understand correctly in the phone conversation you and I had, Joe, you don't have enough wire to build all of the elements of that dipole. You're going to have to go out and get some other wire. And I know you were concerned about whether or not the compatibility between the different kinds of wire for the different elements of this multi-frequency dipole, this fan dipole, whether or not that would create interaction. And I think we're talking about a tertiary effect, not even a secondary effect. So if I used a brand A, if I used aluminum clad steel wire for one of those dipoles, I used copper 14-gauge household wire for another one of those dipoles, And if I use silver-plated 16-gauge wire for another one of those dipoles, even though it would look different on each one of those dipoles, and you would worry about their interoperability, their compatibility, and so on, I think as you substituted any one of those dipoles with any of the other materials, you'd have great difficulty seeing a difference in performance because of the kinds of wire you used. Your major requirement here is good mechanical support so that in the wind and ice in the wintertime we get on Long Island, the thing will have survivability. In your case, where you want a rather critical tuning because you're a little more of a scientist than many of the other guys building dipoles, by way of a halyard mechanism, by which you can lower the dipole to the ground and therefore do the adjustment and then haul it back up, that's my recommendation. There is no simple way of tuning the dipole 5 feet off the ground and having it give you a predictable performance when it's 50 feet above the ground. A lot of that signal coming out of the dipole reflects off the ground, comes back to your dipole, depending on the distance it has to travel to go down to the ground, reflect off the ground, and come back, determines what phase angle of reflected signal the dipole sees. Therefore, if you plotted center frequency versus altitude of your dipole, you would see a somewhat complicated curve. There is a similar curve in one of the chapters of the AROL antenna book showing you something about change in resonant frequency versus altitude off the ground in wavelengths. So there's a bit of predictability there, but still, if you want to do a real good job, it's going to take some on-the-spot tweaking, if you know what I mean, because you're also getting some local capacitive effect from the nearby trees, from the downspouts and gutters of the house and the wiring of the house. I mean, you think that dipole sees nothing but the air that's around it. Well, electronically, it sees a hell of a lot of reflections off of a hell of a lot of other objects. Those reflections are usually small, and the effects are usually secondary effects, but they're still there. Maybe that helps a little, Joe. W2RYY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, I have a comment and a question. The comment is, I can't make a fan dipole. I don't have the room to do that, to spread something out 10 degrees between elements. So what it's going to be, is going to be a constructed type of arrangement where all the wires are going to be pretty much next to each other and just change length on the dipole. So that's how I'm going to have to build it, because I don't have the physical room, and hauling it up by a hoist mechanism in the center is not going to work either. I don't have the means to be able to do something like that. Not the way it's going to be supported. I don't have trees on the property to be able to do that. I only have some sort of supporting things, I would call them, on each end to be able to support. I'm going to be hanging hung in the center off an existing mount on the roof, and be suspended away from that mount on a pipe about maybe 10 feet away from it. So getting to that when it's in its final location can be tough. But the question I have related to the subject is this. If you're running, say, about 100 watts or so on a into the antenna at its resonant frequency, what kind of voltage would you expect to see at the end of the dipole? Not looking at, say, like 80 meters, because that can be the longest length, but saying like you take a another one like 40 meters, or 20 meters, it's going to be half the length of 80, and then 20 again would be half the length of 40. My question relating to that would be, would you have to worry about the RF jumping off the end of that wire or going through the insulation at some point near the ends of the antenna and causing you a problem for the thing, so to speak, shorting out to the longer related antenna above it? You think that would be a problem or not a problem? Back to you.
Most of the time, that's not a problem, Joe. Most of the dipoles you and I are likely to build in our backyard have a Q of approximately 10. Now, there's about 5 or 6 separate definitions for the word Q, but they are all related to the exact same phenomena of physics, but different ways of sensing that phenomena. Q is often defined as voltage rise at resonance. Sometimes it's defined as current rise at resonance. sometimes it's defined as center frequency divided by half power bandwidth. Sometimes it's defined as the rate of change of phase versus the change in frequency. Sometimes it's defined as time, so to speak. All of those are the exact same phenomena, different ways of measuring. Let me drop. I'm going to choose one of those definitions, voltage rise at resonance. If my dipole is at the center frequency, has a resistive impedance of 70 ohms, and if I'm putting 1,000 watts of power into it, you and I know that power is E squared over R, where R is 70 ohms. You know what the power is, you can solve for that formula. And so a kilowatt at 70 ohms, I don't know the exact frequency, the exact power, the exact voltage, but it's probably in the vicinity of 300 volts RMS. So a kilowatt at 73 ohms is something in the vicinity of 300 volts that you're applying to the center of the dipole. Because the dipole usually has a Q in the vicinity of 10, and voltage rise of 10 means that the 300 volts is now raising to 3,000 volts. So tip-to-tip voltage on the dipole is going to be close to 3,000 volts in my example. Each side is going to be 1,500 volts RMS to ground. So do you have enough separation so you're not going to arc over at 1,500 volts, where air usually has a dielectric strength of 30,000 volts per centimeter? So a good-sized egg insulator that we amateurs use for our antennas usually is more than enough, and you're going to arc over the air between the tips of one dipole and the other? Very unlikely with the numbers I'm talking about here. Let me drop. And when I was talking about pulleys on the tops of trees and poles and whatever, so you can haul up your dipole to the desired altitude and then lower it to the ground. That halyard mechanism I just described, whether you do it on the right-hand tip of the dipole and you lower it to the ground, the left-hand tip of the dipole and you lower it to the ground, or the center support of the dipole and you lower it to the ground, those are your choices. No matter how you support the dipole, guarantee there are ways that you can come up with a pulley mechanism that would allow you to lower it to the ground without you climbing the tree, without you climbing the tower, if you so desire. Now, when it comes to a fan dipole, one single support. So you assume now I'm building a dipole that is going to be physically laid out north to south. I've got a tree on the north side of my property that's the northern end for support. I've got a tree on the south side of my property that's the southern end for support. Let me drop. And those are the two mechanical supports, and the center feed line hangs as a catenary, if you know what I mean. By the right kind of weighting structure and extra insulating ropes and whatever, with one single support on the northern end of the property, I can support the 80-meter dipole, the 40-meter dipole, the 20-meter dipole, and the 10-meter dipole by having the string in between them being vertically weighted. They're now vertically spaced 10 degrees, 5 degrees, or whatever from each other by the vertical weighting of the single support on the northern end of the property and the single support on the southern end of the property. It takes a little bit of mechanical engineering smarts to do that, but one single support at each end of your structure can support all of the individual dipoles of your fan dipole assembly. I know you could respond to do that, Joe. W-H-U-R-Y-Y, K-2-R-I-W in the TechNet.
Okay, we'll have to think about that one, how I'm going to be able to do that. I can only support it at one end and really get to it easily, even its final resting place. One end is going to be a pole because it simply goes one way. There's no tree on that side of my property, so I have like a 20-25-foot pole to help pull that end up and keep it, get it off the ground. The other end is supported by something else. I can get to it. But I was more worried about trying to, you know, have it supported maybe at the ends correctly where they're going to be, but the center would be much, much lower. That would be where my problem would be if it's just going to change the tuning very, very erratically or not. I guess I'm going to have to just try and trial everything and try with one band at a time and see what kind of effect they have between having it close to the ground and then far away from the ground, to see what kind of effect it changes, if it changes the resonant frequency and it changes the effective bandwidth of what the antenna apparently displays on test instrumentation. Back to you. So it's going to be, I guess, a trial and error thing. I thought it was maybe something simple to give it a little more predictability, like if it's 5 feet on the ground, you can expect this. If 25 feet on the ground, you can expect something else.
There is a chapter of the ARO antenna book which shows you a spiral graph where the resistance is plotted vertically, the reactance is plotted horizontally, and that spiral graph has a bunch of dots on it where frequencies are mounted on those dots. And I think there's a similar graph where they change the altitude of the antenna and you look at the slight change in frequencies and whatever. So some of that is predictable. Another thing is that if this is the best of, world, of all worlds, you would like your dipole fan structure, every one of those dipoles, to be thoroughly symmetric. Therefore, you think when you're doing the tuning, if you're going to take 3 inches off the right-hand side, you think you have to also take 3 inches off the left-hand side. Absolutely not. The fact that you want to feed it in the absolute center is somewhat academic. You can feed a single dipole at the center, 10% off of center, 50% off center, 75% off center, or the outer tip. The impedance changes when you do that, but the dipole will give you full performance no matter where you feed it if you're smart enough to know what you're doing. The bottom line of all that is that once you have your fan dipole where you've selected the right lengths to be in the ballpark before you put it up the first time, and you find out that some of the individual dipoles on 80 meter or 40 meter or 20 meter is a little bit too long, let me drop. A little bit too long or a little bit too short. And with your halyard mechanism, you could only lower the outer northern end of this dipole assembly, and you don't have access to the southern end. And so you lower the northern end, and you make the lengths longer and shorter of each of those dipoles only on the northern end. That's a perfectly acceptable way to do it. And the fact that they become a little bit non-symmetric is, we're gilding the lily here. The fact that the one dipole is because of one you made a little bit longer by trimming the northern end, and another one of the dipoles you made a little bit shorter by trimming at the northern end, you now have one dipole fed at the 51% point, your dipole fed at the 49% point. The RF energy wouldn't give a darn. Would make almost no difference. So you can do all of the tuning per se at one end, Joe, and nothing bad will happen. This thing is nowhere near as sensitive as you think. You'll be amazed how forgiving it is. And once you go and do it, a fair number of the things that you're concerned about, you're going to find out were really a straw man. When you finally come back after doing this, you're going to say, except for my mechanical engineering problems and properly getting the support and the halyard mechanism, except for a little bit of grief on that, and you have to make sure you've got enough, let me drive. You have to make sure that your pulley mechanism has enough adaptability or, what's the word I'm looking for, accommodation. You have to recognize the fact that every tree on a windy day, particularly on a very windy day, is going to sway an amount that you wouldn't believe. So that if your pulley mechanism doesn't have enough springiness, the right kind of a weight that can move up and down, if it can't accommodate the movement of the tree, then things will get broken. I remember one of the dipoles I sprung between two trees with a great big long spring on each end. And I thought, oh, now the spring will have the compliance to allow the tree to sway. Well, the tree swayed a hell of a lot more than I thought it was going to, and my spring eventually fell into mechanical failure. And I thought the mechanical failure would take, 10 years to happen with rusting and whatever. Well, it happened in about 3 months. And I eventually realized I needed a lot more compliance. My trees on my property sway a lot more. So except for some mechanical problems, the electrical problems are nowhere as bad as you would think, Joe. To me, K2LYY, come back when you do this. And I think you're going to mostly have good news, Joe. K2LYW in the TechNet.
Very good, Dick. I will definitely try to write down what I do and keep notes on the thing as far as length and so forth and how it ends up working out. And it's amazing when we get into these projects how you get smarter as you go along.
It's all a great big learning curve. And when it comes to real antenna engineering, an extremely high percentage of the real antenna engineering in his world took place by ham radio operators or by way of an engineer who really has the ham radio philosophy. Tune it, tweak it, adjust it, experiment with it. If you think that every antenna can be modeled on a computer, you're very naive. An awful lot of the antennas that you can tweak in your backyard for better performance, not always can the computer predict it. Of all of the antennas I've worked on over the last 30 years, let me think now, of those 30 antenna patents that have my name on them, about 25 of those antennas would never be found with the currently available computer modeling programs. I'll admit that these are unusual antennas made out of sheet metal, very wide resonators out of sheet metal at 915 megacycles for the frequency use of radio frequency identification interrogators, readers, if you know what I mean. So these are antennas that have to operate with extremely low standing wave ratio. Let me drop. I'm talking about three-element Yagi-like antennas having 6 decibels of gain, where the standing wave ratio between 902 and 928 megacycles, that's approximately a 3% bandwidth. Across that bandwidth, the antenna has to keep the gain of 6 dB and have a standing wave ratio of approximately 1.05 to 1.1 maximum standing wave ratio across that frequency range. You try to design that on a computer program, and you'll soon realize it ain't going to do it. But if you start off with the right kind of a vector network analyzer on an antenna range that is 3 feet long in between my desk and my conference table in the office where I was doing this work, and you scatter some absorbing materials around the room to stop the ground reflection and the wall reflection and the ceiling reflection, and you do the development on that particular antenna range, which can measure nothing but forward gain, it cannot measure pattern. You swing that antenna to try to measure the pattern, and you're going to be lighting up other things in the room. It doesn't measure antenna pattern. I didn't give a darn what the antenna pattern was. As long as the forward gain had 6 dB of gain, that's all I cared about in antenna pattern. Front to back ratio, I didn't give a darn. Did it have 6 dB of forward gain, and was the standing wave ratio, let me drop, was the standing wave ratio low enough across that 3% bandwidth? The answer was yes and yes. That was a successful design, and it became part of the patent. And it was found by tweaking, by cutting up pieces of copper tape, this kind of copper tape you buy that's got the I can give you the patent number. When you look at the physical layout of that Yagi, you will say, boy, that's a strange-looking structure. Yeah, now that I know what I'm looking at, I can see the director, I can see the driven element, and I can see the reflector. But that's a very strange-looking Yagi. But my goodness, is that thing high in performance. It's got 50 cents worth of materials, not counting the coaxial structures of that antenna. And you write them down as a specification, and you send it out to every antenna vendor you've got in the United States and Europe and Asia, and every one of them will no bid. They're saying they can't do that. And some little old ham radio operator named K2RIW did a bunch of tweaking with a vector network analyzer and found that whole class of antennas. So as you can tell, ham radio tweakers are really where an awful lot of antenna design takes place. You would think that a guy, let me drop. You think that a guy would go to the best electrical engineering school that teaches RF engineering. It might be Georgia Institute of Technology. It might be the Stanford University. It might be the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. It might be the Rochester Institute of Technology. You start up with one of these very good schools. You get an enthusiastic guy there who takes the fields and waves course. He learns the living daylights about Maxwell's equations in the integral form, the differential form, and whatever, and he can juggle those equations like in his sleep. And you think that that guy is going to walk into a laboratory and design an antenna. You believe that, and I'm going to tell you another. And you think now he's got the foundation by which he can do antenna design. You talk to the guys who are really working for the antenna development department of any good-sized electrical engineering company that does RF work, and you find out they use some very different techniques. They don't use Maxwell's equations. They each have their own fancy ways of setting up the instrumentation and doing tweaking. It really is the ham radio philosophy 90% of the time, whether the guy's got a ham radio license or not. And usually the chief antenna designer of any company has a book on his shelf which is mounted backwards, where the pages of the book are mounted forward, the spine of the book, you don't see it. And when you take the book off the shelf, what is it? The ARRO antenna book, or the radio amateur's handbook. And he's using that as a professional antenna designer, and he's not willing to admit where the information is coming from. Now you know one of the secrets. John's going to tell us another one of the secrets. K2, Foxtrot Quebec Uniform. I hope you're still with us, John. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Thank you, K2RIW. K2, I'm still within range. I'm getting you guys stationary right now. I hope I'm hitting the repeater. Over.
A little bit of noise in there, but we're getting 95% copy. Don't worry, John. Go right ahead. Go ahead with your question.
Thanks very much. My question is about 6 meters. Recently with my APOS 120, I've noticed on WB2HWW's 6 meter, and I've been getting a lot of static. And I noticed that the static was higher with the noise blanketer setting on my Yaesu 857 set up to 100%. And when I dropped it down to zero and even turned it off, I noticed the static disappeared. I do know that the 6 meter has been up and down recently. Usually hit that pretty good, but my question is, anybody on the TechNet might know what can cause a noise blanketer to cause more sound on a frequency over other frequencies. I've gone through 40, 20, 15, and 10, and it is quiet. So that's my question.
I do remember the days when I operated 6 meters. If you've got a really sensitive receiver, a good low noise preamplifier, so you're getting very good sensitivity, an amazing number of things in the domestic environment make static, fluorescent lighting, and heaters for fish tanks, and rotary machinery, oh boy, a drill motor, for instance, or an electric mixer in the kitchen can drive a 6 meter receiver crazy. So depending on where you're living, depending where the nearest shopping center is located, depending on what kind of equipment they've got, whether they've got the low temperature or low pressure or high pressure sodium lighting for the parking lot, there's lots of things that can make radio interference. The way some of the noise blankers work, let me drop, is that the noise blanker must have, on its detecting circuit, an extremely wide bandwidth. Some of the noise blankers will look at a frequency region a lot wider than you care about. In other words, you may be tuning the 6 meter band from 50.1 to 50.2 99% of the time, but your noise blanker might be looking at 49.9 to 52 megacycles inclusive in order to have enough bandwidth to see the leading edge of the spike of noise coming into that antenna, so that it has a priori knowledge as to when to do its blanking function. For the noise blanker to do its job well, the noise blanker detector has to have a greater bandwidth than the receiver you're using. The good news is it can now do its blanking very sharply in timing. It does it fast enough so that very little of the undesired noise comes through. That's the good news. The bad news is that there's a local transmitter somewhere in that wide frequency region of the noise blanker that's giving a strong signal to the front end, that you could be doing blanking at signals that are not giving you interference on your particular frequency. It could be false alarming the blanker. That's one possible guess as to what can be going on. By way of fox hunting techniques, if by some means you can get a hold of or build a portable 6 meter receiver, Maybe it's part of your mobile rig. Maybe it's a battery operation on your normal base station rig. And you walk around the neighborhood, even with a simple rubber duck-like antenna. But as you walk around the neighborhood, you may find out a particular telephone pole, a particular house, a particular business, a particular store, a particular factory has very strong radio noise that your 6-meter receiver or its blanker picks up. So you may be able to pin down where it's coming from. It might not necessarily be a failure of the receiver that you're experiencing this grief on, John. It could be something about your local environment. And if you find out what the source is in the local environment, and if you're a diplomatic enough person, you may be able to talk to the owner of that noisy piece of equipment and make a correction. You may find out